Hey, true crime family, I'm Kay Mack, going solo today, and this is Bad Human. Hey, true crime family, welcome to Bad Human, a true crime podcast where we discuss those humans that reside at the bottom of the morality bell curve. Apologies for the delay. Thank you, everyone who sent emails, Instagram messages, carrier pigeons, wellness checks. We are very much alive. There has just been a lot going on in our lives, but missed you all so much that we did not want you to have to wait any longer. The answer is off on his own endeavors with his YouTube channel for the foreseeable future. So you are stuck with me. However, the band will be getting back together at some point, but true crime never stops and we didn't want you to wait anymore. So you will get the privilege of listening to me, which, let's be real, I am the talent anyhow. Just kidding. And of course, my trusty rescue dog, Charlotte. Thank you to everyone who follows us on Instagram at Bad Human Pod. Check it out. We post images, photos about the cases. Love to hear your thoughts in the comment section. And if you have any case requests or feedback, as you know, we like positive and coaching. Feedback is a great way to say it. You can hit us up at badhumanpodcast@gmail.com. So with that, let's get right to it. You've waited long enough. Let's not wait anymore. The case today that we're going to be discussing is extremely controversial and still, even though it occurred many, many years ago, is very much being discussed in the courts as of just a few months ago. So definitely want to hear your thoughts in the comment section on the gram. Sunday, April 30th, 1989, the congregation of Olive Branch Church in Lakeville, Indiana, was gathering for the 9:30 a.m. service when several of them noticed the absence of Pastor Bob, his wife, and their five children. This was definitely not like him, as he was always there early to greet his peeps as they entered the church. The Pelly family consisted of Bob, who had a 17-year-old son, Jeff, and a 14-year-old daughter, Jackie. And then Bob had married Dawn, who brought three daughters into their marriage, 9-year-old Jesse, 8-year-old Janelle, and 6-year-old Jolene. Love the name Jolene. When the time for service came and they were all a no-show, people started to freak the fuck out. Were they sick? Not likely that the whole brood was down for the count. Had they gone out of town? Most people were like, that'd be pretty shitty for him to just bounce and not have the sermon covered. So people definitely figured that something was amiss. A young girl had gone next door to the pastor's house. She was friends with the daughters. This was pretty standard. She'd go over there and hang out with them before service. She knocked on the door. No one answered. When she tried the handle, it was locked. She then went to the other side of the house and it was locked too. Now, this was definitely not the norm, as typically, A, their home wasn't locked, and B, by this point, especially on Sunday morning, which is like, I'm sure like the pastor's like favorite day of the week, they would be up and going. So this, like, something was definitely sus. Freaked out, she ran back across the parking lot to the church where she talked to her dad. She told her father what was up, and the parishioners decided something had gone terribly wrong and went to the parsonage, which is what their home was called, next to the church to check on the pastor and his family. Their first instincts were to try peeking through the window, but the blinds were closed, which again, this is uncharacteristic as well. Like, to be clear, and I was talking to somebody else about this yesterday, I think, never be the person that does the wellness check. If somebody calls you and asks you, and we've talked about this before, if somebody calls you and asks you to go check on someone and something seems weird, don't fucking do it, because the odds are you're going to see something that you don't want to see, and then you're going to get sucked into a whole whirlwind of shit. So do not be the person that is the first to go in. However, I do applaud the parishioners who were concerned for Pastor Bob and their family. They tried to look through the blinds. They were closed. They knocked loudly. No answers. People started to get super uneasy. And there was a gentleman who there was, Will was his name. I don't know why you all need to know Will. If you know Will Tisdale, shout out to Will, had used a spare key from the church to enter the home. And what they found next was absolutely horrifying. Upon entering the home in the upstairs hallway, they found Bob Pelly's glasses on the floor. He was lying face up nearby with two gunshot wounds, one in the chest and one in the face. Immediately, they called 911. While waiting for help to arrive, some of the parishioners decided to walk around the house. Like, listen, I get wanting to see if anybody needs help, but if you're contaminating a crime scene, although, in their defense, I don't know anybody who's listened to our episode on the Villisca axe murders where people were, like, walking around the home taking skull bone fragments as, like, for a keychain souvenir. That was super fucked up. So people decided, though, and I'm sure it was just to make sure that if anybody needed help, they got it. Walked around the house. They saw, they opened the basement door and looked down. At the bottom of the stairs, they saw a pair of feet that were still wearing socks. Considering no one else was around the upstairs, they assumed that it was the rest of the Pelley family. The police discovered, so at least they didn't go down the steps. So they opened the door, saw somebody's feet with socks. They're like, fuck this, pass, let's wait for the police. The police discovered Dawn Pelley and her two daughters, Janelle and Jolene, dead in the basement. This is so heartbreaking. Dawn had her arms wrapped around the girls as though she had died trying to protect them. The girls were just 8 and 6 years old. All four of the Pelley family victims had been shot in the face at close range with a shotgun. Oddly, nothing else seemed out of place in the home. It didn't appear to be a burglary with the home, so it wasn't ransacked. There was no signs of forced entry, no sign of a murder weapon, no sign of ammunition, and the doors were all locked from the inside. When the police and ambulance arrived, the parishioners told officers what they had found inside. They also informed police of the three Pelley children, 17-year-old Jeff, 14-year-old Jackie, and 9-year-old Jesse, were still unaccounted for. Police began processing the crime scene and searching for the three missing Pelley children. Luckily, they were able to account for the daughters. Jesse had been in a sleepover and Jackie was at church camp about 90 minutes away. Jeff was a tad harder to find. A few church members said Jeff's prom had been the night before, but he had been barred due to basically being an asshole and he got grounded. So Jeff, we'll get to this. Jeff appears to have some behavioral opportunities. They also saw that a shotgun was missing from a gun rack on the wall. Soon thereafter, police found the remnant of a shotgun shell embedded in a book, which further confirmed their belief that the missing shotgun was the murder weapon. When Jessie returned home from her friend's house where she had spent the night, she was confused by the activity taking place at her house. She was only, can you imagine, she's only 9 years old. She was at a sleepover. She rolls up back to her home, probably having a night of fun with her friends. I don't know, do people prank calls? How old am I? Prank call, like dance routines, like, you know, coloring, whatever the fuck kids do. I don't even know now. I'm so old and uncool. But to have this wonderful, like, sleepover, she gets home and her home is swarming with ambulances, police cars, no clue what the fuck's going on. Soon enough, though, she would learn the horrible truth about her parents and sisters. Despite her shock and trauma, she was able to tell detectives that Jeff was on a class trip to Six Flags. He and Jackie were summoned home immediately. Police began to piece together what may have happened the night before. So let's talk about the night before. So Jeff Pelley was a 17-year-old high school senior. Pretty much your typical 17-year-old boy at his age, kind of awkward, right, between like adolescence and adulthood, trying to be independent, but always getting into trouble, a bit of a little shit stir. And just like many fathers of teenage boys, Bob had tried to keep his son on the straight and narrow with firm discipline. Bob's position as a preacher, you know, clearly meant that his son's behavior reflected on his abilities as a moral leader. However, I will say, and I've heard this so many times, growing up with a father as a police chief, that people always say the kids that act out the most are typically pastors' children and police officers, law enforcement. So I'm not going to agree or disagree with that. I'm sure if you ask my dad, he would probably say that that is the truth. But keep in mind, again, his dad's the pastor, so I'm sure there was pressure on Jeff to not be, you know, a total menace to society. He had, however, had recent trouble that involved petty theft. Specifically, remember, this is 1989. He got in trouble for stealing CDs and cash from a nearby home. And as a punishment, Bob had forbidden his son from attending prom night activities. So he was able to go to prom, but literally that's it. You go to prom, you get your ass back home. He was also forbidden from driving his Ford Mustang. His father would only be the permissible form of transportation to and from prom for Jeff and his date. So not only is Jeff not allowed to go to any of the prom pre or post parties or activities, he is not allowed to drive his Stang. Only Bob can be his chauffeur. Now, I'm sure, Jeff was pissed, but who wouldn't be upset, especially if you're a high school senior and this is your senior prom. Apparently, there was a bit of a shouting match between him and his father. Jeff had tossed out the threat of leaving and never coming back. Nothing really that none of us, I'm sure, or most of us, not to generalize, at some point in your high school career had this argument with your parents, right? Where you threatened to run away or move out, or you say you hate them. All the things that are why I am not upset that I do not have a child. Just kidding. Okay, now keep in mind there was tension in the family though before the CD stealing situation. So Bob and Don had only been married 1 year after the passing of his wife. So Jeff, his mom passes, a year later, Bob gets remarried, which this created some tension between all of Bob's children, but especially with Bob and Jeff. However, in an effort to unify the family, Bob and Don formally adopted one another's children. So from outside, the Pelly family looked like a modern-day Brady Bunch. But however, behind closed doors, and the more that this case things started to come to the surface, that was a total facade for the most part. I mean, I'm sure there were happy moments, but there were also some that were certainly not the idyllic family that they portrayed every Sunday. Jackie argued with Dawn over her old-fashioned ways of raising children, which Jackie believed were oppressive for young girls. Jesse and Bob were strict disciplinarians who expected, I'm sorry, Jesse said that Bob was a strict disciplinarian who expected his family to be the perfect preacher's children. So sounds like you have a lot of areas of contention already brewing in this little tea kettle. You have the mother who passed, dad immediately remarries. Dad remarries someone who the kids feel is from like Little House on the Prairie mothering style. There's a lot of things going on here. Whether it was the kids' disagreements with their step parents or frustrations with their own parents, people later described the family home to be turbulent, to say the least. Now, police were already aware of Jeff's run-in with petty theft, but after taking statements from a few of Bob's friends at the church, they learned that chances were slim Bob would have had a change of heart about Jeff driving his car. According to friends, Bob had even gone so far as to remove certain vital pieces of the Mustang's engine to make sure Jeff didn't sneak out with the car. Bob was very determined to get Jeff back on the right track. That's takes some balls. Jeff is like, not only, or Bob's like, Jeff, not only are you not going to drive your vehicle, I'm going to dismantle this motherfucker so you can't even like try to drive it. Like, I commend you, Bob, a little aggressive. But so essentially, the parishioners are saying there was definitely tension to the point that even the night before, there was a rumor that Jeff called or Bob called dibs on the engine of Jeff's Mustang. Also, during the initial investigation, a well-known forensic pathologist was driving past and saw a commotion. He stopped to see what was going on and offered his services. Police greatly accepted this, thinking that it would be a great service. So you have all this commotion going on outside of the patronage. I think it's what it's called. It's been a minute since I have entered the Lord's home. You have this forensic pathologist driving by, sees that there's some shit going down. He's like, hey, rolls up, let me help. The pathologist, typically in their job, some of you may know this, but just to level set, essentially, their job is to take very extensive and critical notes of the scene, inclusive of estimating time of death, state of rigor, the way the blood has settled in the corpse. We saw this in like the Adnan Syed case, where based on like how the blood had positioned itself in the body and the trunk, you can tell, what happened. However, The records only come from the autopsy report. So this guy didn't take any notes, didn't take their body temperature, didn't note the state of rigor mortis they were in. So yeah, he kind of shit the bed on that one. Essentially, he offered his services. They got a lemon with him. He took no notes. And so all they had to really go off of eventually was the autopsy. Police also did a half-assed job on investigating the scene. They didn't really dig in for clues or dust for prints. My gut and what a lot of people believe is that they felt from the onset that Jeff was their dude. And so they basically kind of were like, eh, yeah. Which I hear this in a lot of shows. And I've just started binge watching SWAT. I don't know if anybody else watches it, but mostly because there are some really hot dudes, which I can say this because the answer is not recording. But they say, let the evidence drive you. Don't try to make the evidence work for your theory. I'm sure they say it like way better. But what it sounds like here is that the police already had an idea that Jeff was their person. They had also apparently found a photo album on Jeff's bed that was had basically, it was called Our Baby's First 7 Years. Cops thought maybe that was Jeff's way of saying goodbye, reminiscing of his previous life. There were also washcloths draped over the shower. The thought was maybe the killer had taken time to clean themselves up. The washer had also recently been run, but the load was very small. A single pair of socks and a shirt. They sprayed with Luminol looking for blood. They said it lit up like a Christmas tree. However, during that time period, many detergents contained phosphates that light up the Luminol the same as blood would. So I'm not really sure what they were trying to accomplish there. Also, the iron in the water could have caused a false positive. Not a lot of, I think, validity to the spraying of the Luminol. I also will say that there's been times where I think we're all guilty. You put one or two things in the wash because you need to get it done quick. So maybe you could debunk the theory that had anything to do with the case as well. The autopsy concluded the family had all been shot with a 20-gauge deer slug, with Bob first shot in the chest that severed his spinal cord and dropped to the floor. The killer then stood over him and fired the second blast. This is very personal, for sure. And a shotgun is so damaging. Dawn was missing two fingers from her right hand. They theorize this must have happened when she raised her hand to try to block the shot. She was then shot once near the right temple. Based on the blood spatter, they determined Dawn died first, followed by Janelle and Jolene being last. The police were not sure who had done it. Actually, the police at this point, like I said, had an idea of who had done it. Now they wanted to try and prove it. Jeff and his girlfriend had been detained at the theme park security office while the rest of their friends were taken to the local PD for questioning. Jeff kept asking if he was in trouble, but the police, the park police and authorities did not say anything to him until the Lakeville police showed up. I mean, that had to be terrifying that your friends are all taken to the police station and then you're stuck being held in the Six Flags security office. Jeff kept asking if he was in trouble, but again, the park police and authorities were told not to say anything. After a while, they finally broke down and told him the news. They said he cried and asked questions about how they died. However, when St. Joseph's County Detective, John, I think his last name is Bodich, questioned Jeff, accompanied by his grandparents, who sat on either side of him, they said his behavior was very different. Jeff was asked about his reaction to learning that his family was murdered. He responded, "I was shocked and started crying. I don't know how it could happen. I don't know why it would happen." However, he then slumped over, put his head in his hands, and asked if he'd be going to jail that night and if he would get the electric chair. And that escalated very quickly. However, there's no recording of Jeff saying that, and it was only the detective's word that he had said, as we go through this case, there are a lot of things that don't either add up, that can't be corroborated, that may seem like sloppy policing. So, and it just continues to grow, which makes this case so controversial. On the record, Jeff denied killing his family and kept insisting that he drove his car to the prom and attended the class trip because his father had relented in his punishment. Now, some people even corroborated this and said Bob was the kind of dad who over-disciplined at first but calmed down. But then this is like the total opposite of what other people had said, where Bob would never give in to the point he literally put that like fucking car on blocks so that Jeff could not drive it to the prom. Detectives weren't buying it. It had been clear to them from the onset that there was no love lost between the father and son. But was missing prom enough to turn someone into a murderer? That seems like a pretty big jump. The theory they started with was that he had killed his dad in a fit of rage and then turned the gun on his stepmom and stepsisters to ensure there were no witnesses. Now remember, those girls were 8 and 6. So to be so pissed that you could not go to prom, not even go to prom, just to the prom's activities. He could still go to prom, just not drive himself. Police are saying that he was so pissed that he could not attend activities and drive his car that he was willing to shoot his dad, his stepmom, and then his 8 and 6-year-old stepsisters all with a shotgun at close range. I mean, I don't know. I went to prom and I didn't think it was that fucking great, but that was just my experience. But given the lack of evidence, cops had to piece together, basically using eyewitness testimony. One of his friends had stopped over to say hi before the prom and noted that Jeff was in jeans and a pink t-shirt, so not dressed for prom. But also, he said all of the family was alive and well. He realized he'd forgotten his date's corsage, so he left, but nothing seemed off in the friend's opinion. However, when he drove past later, all the blinds were closed, the lights were off, and it appeared that everyone was gone. However, he did claim to see Jeff's car in the driveway. 30 minutes later, he drove past, and this time Jeff's car was gone. These are really important statements. The police literally just pulled together this case, essentially using what I would consider subjective witness testimony. So basically, you have one friend who's saying he stopped over to say hi before prom. Jeff was dressed cash, not for prom. The family was alive and kicking. He realized he forgot the corsage, bounced, drove past. Later, all the blinds were closed, the lights were off, and Jeff's car was in the driveway. Drove past again 30 minutes later, and now Jeff's car was gone. Kim Oldenburg, a classmate of Jeff's, stopped by the Pelly home with her mother and date before going to prom. Kim claimed that she felt a great deal of tension during the visit and said Jeff seemed angry and sullen. They were supposed to also, the Pelly family was also supposed to go to a friend's house. They were late and started to wonder where were Bob and Don. They said they were going to come by to take pictures and see their daughter's prom dress, but they never showed. About 15 minutes after, they decided to drive over and see what's going on, but no one was there, so they left. So you have a classmate now, Kim, who said she went over before the prom. There was a lot of tension, things felt off. You have another family that Bob and Don were supposed to go over to that family's home before prom to take pictures and see their daughter's dress. They never showed. That family claims that they went over to the Pelly home to see what was going on. No one was there. This is a lot of activity for prom. I didn't realize that people took this shit like so seriously. At 6 o'clock the same evening, the Pelly's neighbor was mowing his lawn when he noticed the tightly drawn curtains. Like everyone else, he found it strange, as was the basement light that was still burning after 9 o'clock that evening. Also around the same time, so earlier, this is all like around 5:20-ish, Jeff had called his date Carla to let her know he'd be late picking her up. With no sign of Bob in the car, an Amco station attendant stated that Jeff had come inside, asked to use a wrench because his car was idling. After a few minutes under the hood, Jeff returned the tool and was on his way. Now we have Jeff with someone putting him around 5:20 behind the wheel of the Mustang with no sign of Bob at a gas station asking to borrow a wrench because he was having car issues. Jeff eventually picked up Darla, his date, at a friend's house at around 5:30 and went to South Bend for a celebratory dinner. Then attended the dance for the rest of the evening. After the prom, Jeff and his date joined the other seniors at the local bowling alley. When they were done bowling, Jeff and Darla went to Kim's house for a post-prom slumber party. Oh, I mean, just co-ed slumber party. That's impressive. Piecing together Jeff's night, police found a window of 20 minutes where his activities could not be accounted for. I mean, I don't know about you, but that seems like a very small window to kill your entire family, pick up all but one of the casings, hide the gun, take a shower, start the laundry, go fix your car, get to your date's house, and change. Not saying it's impossible. However, Jeff is essentially a superhero. That's how fast he's moving. Also, for anyone who has shot a shotgun, which I have one time and about dislocated my fucking shoulder, that kickback is legit. So whoever did the shooting would definitely have had probably bruising, most likely from the recoil, especially after how many shots were fired. I think I said it was 20 shots. They took photos of Jeff's upper body and torso. There was not one single bruise. He was eventually released, but cops decided to keep a close eye on him, especially at the funeral. He showed little emotion, which was a huge red flag for cops. However, his sister said that's how their family had been told to deal with emotions. So the fact that he was stoic was basically, in her opinion, par for the course in how they'd handled loss in the past, which I have learned over the last couple of months, just unfortunately losing friends and having other just personal losses. You never know how people are going to handle grief and mourning. We talk about this a lot on the show. So that's kind of a tough one for me, how people react in that setting, and also fucking lie detectors. I have a really hard time putting a ton of faith in, but you know, I'm also not a detective, so there's that. Life went on for the Pelly children. Jeff moved to Florida. Someone was charged. Jeff was never formally charged. He moved to Florida, where he married and became a Sunday school teacher. However, the community made it very clear that he was not welcome there. His stepmother's father, I'm sorry, I'm trying to say that five times fast. His stepmother, Dawn's father, also took over being the trustee of the children's inheritance, with Jeff's share being around $48,000. They were supposed to get it when they turned 21, but Jeff kept asking early and got a big hell to the no. In 1991, he said he had come down with skin cancer, which this was the same thing that killed his mother. So if he was making this up, that's pretty morbid. And said he needed to have surgery to remove it, which had cost him $20,000. The surgery had saved his life, and he had no way to pay it off. He had sent a copy of the bill, and at first it looked real, but when the stepdad, well, I'm sorry, his step-grandfather, I guess, technically, tried to look up the doctor on the bill, he found that they were all fake. He also called the hospital billing department, and they were like, yeah, this didn't happen, which, no shit, but also that sounds like a HIPAA violation to me. Anyhow, they also called the cops. The phone number listed as the hospital billing department was a second phone line that Jeff had installed. His mother-in-law, who worked at the hospital, used her insight to help with the forgery. He pled guilty to wire fraud, spent 6 months on house arrest. Basically, and this isn't helping Jeff's cause here, so he essentially, it looks like, he never admitted to it yet, looks like he lied about having cancer, which is super fucked up because his mom died of cancer, saying that his surgery cost him $20,000 and that he needed his inheritance early, of which they clearly did. This reminds me of, what was that case we covered, like Chandler Halderson, where he lied and said he had gotten a job working for Elon Musk at SpaceX or whatever. Like I said, he pled guilty to wire fraud, spent 6 months on house arrest. He eventually got a job at IBM, and then him and his wife moved. They also, at this point, had a son. And so they hung out there in Florida for the next 6 years. But in 2002, St. Joseph County District Attorney Christopher Toth knew he was not in good standing. People were pissed with his job performance, and one of their biggest gripes was the unsolved Pelly family murders. Toth had previously declined to seek charges against Jeff, as had the district attorney before him. Now, however, he saw this as a way to use the case to leverage voter satisfaction and keep his job. As part of Toth's campaign for re-election, he promised to get justice for the Pellys and secure an indictment from the grand jury against Jeff. On August 2, 2002, Jeff was arrested and charged with murdering his father, stepmother, and adopted sisters. However, that shit didn't work, and Toth's opponent, Michael Dvorak, was sworn into office in January 2003 and took over the prosecution of the case. He, too, had made a similar promise that he was going to solve the Pelly case as well. Can you imagine? 1989 is when the murders happened, and you go on just living your life, and then in 2002, all of a sudden you get a knock on your door that you're arrested. It's wild. They immediately went into investigation mode and talked to his sisters again. Now, keep in mind that this is 10 plus years later. They talked to his stepsister, who'd been put into foster care after the murder, and stated that at one point she thought Bob had killed her mom and sisters before killing himself. So she's saying that she thinks that Bob actually killed Don and the girls before killing himself. However, they didn't find a murder weapon at the scene of the crime. Also be, I mean, not that you can't do it, but I mean, that would be pretty hard logistically to kill yourself with a shotgun and then hide the gun before dying. So I don't know. Back in 1989, when Jeff realized that he was a prime suspect, he and his grandfather had spoke with Michael Dvorak. I think I'm saying that right. Dvorak. I don't know how to say it. Dvorak. He was then a private practice attorney. Now, let's stop for a minute. When Jeff initially, back in 89, was concerned about being a suspect, he had reached out to Michael Dvorak, we're going to say it that way, asking for feedback and, like, you know, hey, what should I do? Like, this is, I'm super concerned, like, you know, whatever else. And now he's the DA prosecuting Jeff. I mean, that to me seems like a huge conflict of interest. However, he refused to step down even after this was brought to his attention and basically said, yeah, I'm not going to recuse myself. We're going to just continue with the prosecution. August 10, 2002, 13 years after the murder, Jeff was formally arrested on four counts. The trial was heavily circumstantial and a clusterfuck of information. Jeff's stepsister claimed, like I said earlier, that, you know, at one point they thought Bob had done it. Then they claimed that Bob had the shotgun on the shelf in his office that was missing after the murder. She also claimed that Jeff had been given permission to go to the theme park the next day, which supported the claim that Jeff had that they had talked things out. However, under oath, his sister contradicted this and said that Jeff had threatened to take his own life a while back, and Bob had asked someone to take the guns. So you have one sister who's saying that there was definitely the gun in the gun rack in that office that was missing after the murders. You have another sister who's saying that Jeff at one point had threatened to kill himself, so their dad had removed the gun from the home. Cops talked to the person who took the guns, and he said that the pastor had come to him and his fa and said that his family was having issues and he needed the guns gone. This guy swore he took three guns, one of them being a shotgun, and still had them when the murders happened. However, now he was unsure. The defense asked the guy to testify because they didn't want to Jeff to appear unhinged, and the prosecution didn't want this because they basically blew up their case. So nobody called this witness, which to me he seems like a pretty critical witness. But like, basically, does the dude have the guns or not? Because if he has the guns and they were removed from the home because Jeff had threatened to kill himself, then that definitely makes Jeff appear unstable. But if he didn't remove the guns and the gun was clearly in the house, then anybody who broke into the home could have used it as a weapon. But everyone's like, yeah, we're all set. Let's not call probably one of the most critical eyewitnesses to the case. Whatever, fuck it. Also, there's a difference in testimony from an eyewitness. They said at the time of the murders, the blood was still wet when they found the bodies. However, on the stand, he said it was dry, which clearly creates a huge difference in the timeline. And cops said for sure they didn't think that he came back after leaving for prom. So if the blood was wet when they found him, then it couldn't have been Jeff, is what their theory is, because they don't think Jeff came back after prom. If the blood was dry, Jeff could have committed the crime before he left for prom and then never came back. There were also a set of keys that were found in the trash at the hours. Excuse me, let me start again. There were also a set of keys found in the trash and that had a key with a locket with photos that no one had any idea who the fuck it was. So you have this. These keys found the trash outside the home that had a locket on it that they're like, I don't know, is anything to do with it? Who knows? But let's not worry about that either. Then you also have the light in the basement that the neighbor said was on way after 9, even to 2 a.m. However, one of the people who found the bodies was adamant that they had to turn the basement light on when they arrived. So let's just real quick again surmise the conflicting information we have here. This is really important. So you have, was the gun in the house? Was the gun not in the house? Had someone taken the guns because Jeff was unhinged? Was the gun there or not? Right? That's a big deal. You have the eyewitness that one point had said the blood was wet when they found the bodies. Now the same person saying the blood was dry. You have someone who's saying that they definitely saw a basement light on way after 2 a.m. But then you have the EMTs who are saying, no, I had to turn the light on when we got there. You have these rando keys that were found in the trash with a locket of photos of no one knows who it is. You also have a woman who called in 2 days after the murder who said she was coming back from the grocery store around 5 o'clock that day and saw Bob talking in the driveway to a man in a black pickup truck. Neither the truck nor the man looked familiar, and she said that Bob looked distressed. She could not recall if Jeff's car was there or not, but since they theorized that the family had died between 5 and 5:30, how could he have done it if his car was gone? Again, despite having only circumstantial evidence against Jeff, and in my opinion, weak at that, on Friday, July 21st, 2006, Jeff was found guilty of murdering his family. I was absolutely floored that he was found guilty. I'm not saying I think he's innocent or guilty. It's very concerning to me as a citizen that with this extremely circumstantial evidence, you can get a murder sentence. Ugh. In October 2006, he was sentenced to 40 years for each murder, a total of 160 years. In April 2008, the Indiana Court, I mean, you can bet your ass that I would appeal the fuck out of this. In April 2008, the Indiana Court of Appeals reversed and remanded Jeff's conviction, allowing him the opportunity to prove his previous defense attorneys mishandled the case and the prosecution misrepresented evidence that violated his constitutional rights. This is really interesting. The central piece of evidence in dispute was a pair of blue jeans. Jeff and his attorneys alleged that prosecutors lied in the first trial when they told jurors that Jeff's jeans had been found in the washing machine and by implication were clean to remove evidence. They presented a 2002 evidentiary memo stating that the jean pockets had contained 34 coins, an illegible receipt when they were first seized. And nowhere did it mention the jeans were found in the washing machine. So in 2002, they present evidence that they had found these jeans in the jeans, in the pocket. There were 34 coins, very specific, an illegible receipt, and that they were not in the washing machine. Also, remember they said that the wash had been run. So if the jeans, which they later claimed were in the washing machine and had been run, I'm sure all of us, if you haven't, then you're a stellar human being, have left shit in your pockets, including a receipt or typically chapstick for me. And when a receipt runs through the washing machine, it does not come out perfectly legible and like how it was before. So now you have conflicting information. Also, none of the police could say for sure who put the jeans in a bag. So you have a chain of custody issue here. Also, why would you put a pair of soaking wet jeans into a paper bag? So just real quick, let's walk through this again because this is really important to understand. So the prosecution initially said that they found these jeans. They didn't say where they found them. And in the jeans, there was some change in a receipt. They later then said that the jeans were apparently found in a washing machine and that the receipt, though, was still legible. Now, they said, though, also that there were clothes that had been found in the washing machine and the machine had been run, which couldn't have been the jeans then because the receipt wouldn't have been legible. They're also saying that the jeans were in a paper bag, paper evidence bag. Why would you put wet jeans in an evidence bag? They also didn't have any sort of chain of custody. So these jeans could very well be critical information. The problem is that it's so gray. How can you base a murder conviction on information? Also, remember that when Jeff got to his girlfriend's house, she had said that he was wearing the jeans and that pink t-shirt, and he changed when he got to the house. And even the person at the gas station said he was wearing the jeans. So how could the jeans that the prosecution is claiming are these, you know, this red herring of evidence truly be that? However, despite these arguments, in February 19th, 2009, the Indiana Supreme Court ruled to reinstate the jury's verdict. So he was like, I mean, tough shit, buddy. Sorry. In 2023, so I told you before, this is still going on. In 2023, Jeff Pally was back in court so his attorneys could make a Hail Mary appeal to St. Joseph County Judge Stephanie Steele. They alleged that Jeff's original attorneys neglected to thoroughly investigate alternate suspects, motives, and theories of the crime, pointing to an exculpatory interview, I can't say that word, exculpatory interview that prosecutors failed to disclose during discovery. This interview is with a woman named Toni Beller, and she suggested the possibility that Jeff's father had ties to organized crime in Florida, and the Pelley murders were acts of revenge by the mob, who were angry when the pastor tried to stop moving their money. She had been hired to photograph the church for a church directory. He insisted he stay out of the picture because he had a life before the church and people wanted him dead. She testified that in 1989, Bob told her, "They are going to kill each member of my family. I'm going to watch and they're going to kill me." And then only days later, the murder took place. She told the police right after the murder, but nothing came of it. The police couldn't prove it, and they said it would be odd, and they just didn't look into it. I mean, However, and this goes all the way back to what I said at the beginning, I feel like they honed in on Jeff from the start and didn't want anything else to be the answer. However, had the police looked into this, they would have found that Bob worked at a bank in Florida before moving there, and this bank was shady as fuck. They were money laundering for the mob and drug trafficking, and Bob had hightailed it out of Florida to the small town in Indiana. Sounds a little suspect to me. There was also another dude who worked at the bank that was killed and found in concrete, so you might have wanted to maybe explore this just a little bit more. Currently, Jeff has been in prison for 18 years out of his 160-year sentence. The courts have asked both sides to submit more legal citations for their arguments. After that, they'll decide if he deserves a new trial. So I don't know. What do you think? To me, there's just too much gray area and circumstantial evidence for me to personally feel comfortable with handing someone a guilty conviction. But there also, as always, are things that we don't know that, you know, we have transpired or the jury heard or saw. So no judgment per se, but I just find it really hard to believe. And not even so much that the jury would find him guilty, but that a prosecutor would feel that comfortable taking this to trial. And then with all of the different just information and evidence that really could be proven to be yes or no. So the whole thing to me is, granted, it's like super, super wild to me. Again, I don't want to judge the jury, but I'm really shocked the prosecution even moved forward. It sounds super shady to me. Definitely, in my opinion, there is a little bit of reasonable doubt. That is the prom night murder case. Again, this is still playing out. We'll keep you posted if we see anything else in the news about a secondary trial. But the mob thing at the end kind of piqued my interest. And definitely, I mean, shotgun to the face certainly could sound like something that organized crime would do. So, like I said, please go to our Instagram page, Bad Human Pod. Would love to hear your thoughts and theories on the case. If you know information about the case, it's a pretty popular case that maybe I missed or you know, you think is important, please add it in the comments. I want to make sure that we are giving the full picture, and we'll be sure to keep you posted. So thank you all for tuning in. Again, you are going to be treated to K-Max angelic voice only for the near future. But as always, please remember to treat yourselves and each other with love, kindness, and respect. I am K-Mac, and that is Charlotte the Rescue Dog snoring. Have a great afternoon.